our speaker, our topic is, the fossil record is more compatible with the model of creation than the model of evolution. Our first speaker is Dr. Von Kappen.
We thank you for coming. We thank you for the opportunity to be here and to address this group, providing the room for us, and we appreciate that. The fossil record is one of my favorite subjects and has been for a long time. As a geologist, I've been accused of having rocks in my head from time to time, but we enjoy that kind of thing. Many people foolishly believe, at least in my estimation, that the fossil record belongs to evolutionists and supports evolution. My experience, my evaluation of the evidence is that is by no means the case, but rather that the fossils provide direct positive evidence for a sudden complex beginning. But first, if we're going to find evidence for evolution, we have to have evidence from the fossils. This is where it's at, if you please. S.M. Stanley of Johns Hopkins University present anything more than an outrageous hypothesis. The fossil record, and only the fossil record, provides direct evidence of major sequential changes in the Earth's biota. Obviously, there's evidence in other areas, but direct evidence that would support a firm conclusion, I think, would have to come from the fossils. But let's also notice this about evidence from the fossils from John Horner. Many of you saw Jurassic Park, the character that that film was based on, the fellow digging up dinosaurs up in Montana, was Jack Horner. He says in his book, Dinosaur Lives, paleontology is a historical science, a science based on circumstantial evidence after the fact, and we can never reach hard and fast conclusions. History doesn't reach the kind of conclusions that hard science reaches. He says these days it's easy to go through school for a good many years, sometimes even through college, without ever hearing that some sciences are historical or by nature inconclusive. So this is the evidence, the only direct evidence, but it's not conclusive evidence even so. But I think there's a strong indication given from the fossil record. One of the ways to compare contrasting models is to make predictions and to see which one is full evidence. Regarding the fossil record, there are obviously very dramatically contrasting predictions that would be made by both. The evolutionist, when he's looking at the beginning of the fossil record, which would probably be the most critical aspect of it, would predict a simple, gradual, linked group of fossils at the beginning of the fossil record, whereas the creationist predicts exactly the opposite, a complex, abrupt, diverse group at the beginning. Now, those two are so dramatically different that we should have no trouble looking at the fossil record to see which one is served best by the evidence. In the continuing record, the evolutionist would predict similarities, branching pattern of similarities due to common ancestry, an allied continuum, a progression, one leading to the other, whereas the creationist would predict similarities due to common designer. It's reasonable to expect similar forms, or common forms from common origin, common designer, similar forms for similar functions. But it would be in a mosaic pattern, not a branching pattern, as the designing artist did or branching. They would be separate and distinct. Stasis would be the order of the day rather than progression. That's how you would distinguish between what's going on in terms of evolution. That's different. Again, you should be able to look and tell which one is served best by the evidence. Well, how will we look and tell? I can tell you what the fossil record is, the nature of it, and many would say, well, you're prejudiced as one who believes in creation. The method that I'm going to be using is that of quotes from the antagonistic witness, from those who are devout believers in evolution. Now, John has had a little hard time getting this concept in previous lectures, and what he's written up after I spoke indicates that this has not sunk in. So let's work on this concept a minute so we understand it. When you have testimony from a friendly witness who testifies in court saying the accused is honest or the accused has no reasonable motive, then that will certainly help. But if you can elicit testimony from an antagonistic witness, then the same testimony takes on much greater weight. If this one who believes the fellow is guilty, obviously, of a motive, then that is much weightier testimony. Friendly testimony helps, but what the lawyer calls acknowledgments contrary to interest are much more weighty, and that's what we'll be using. I don't want anyone to misunderstand. These witnesses are evolutionists. They're devout believers in evolution. They're men of great faith in evolution. Let's not... Now, when you listen to some of the things they say, you'll think, well, now, he's quoting a creationist. No, I don't want to leave that impression. I want that clear. Here's an example. Richard Dawkins is one of the most ardent anti-creationists in the world, from Oxford and Cambridge. He says, we find many of them, speaking of the fossil record, already in an advanced state of evolution the very first time they appear. Now, it's a state of evolution. He believes that. But it's not because there's an evolutionary history. It's because of his faith, because when they appear, they're advanced. It is as though they were just planted there without any evolutionary history. Needless to say, this appearance of sudden planting has delighted the creationist, and I'll plead guilty there. That's what we would predict, and that's another way of saying this is not what we predict, which is the way we test models. National Geographic had an article just a couple of years ago on the lowest layer of the geologic column. When you look in this column where the life begins, below the Cambrian, you've got some blue-green algae and bacteria, but when it really starts, it starts in an explosion, and that's the way they depict it. Stephen Gould, a very devout evolutionist, Harvard, describes it this way. The Cambrian explosion occurred in a geological moment. We have reason to think that all major anatomical designs may have made their evolutionary appearance at that time. Now, he has great faith that it was an evolutionary appearance. Why? Well, not because there's any record of evolution there. When they appeared, when it started, you have all the major anatomical designs. In fact, he says we have more, had more then than we have now. It's gone downhill, as we'll see. Not only the phylum Chordata itself, but also all its major divisions. That's us, that's the animals with backbones. Not saying that we were in the Cambrian, but animals with backbones, our phylum was represented at the very beginning. We're looking, I think, at an environment at the bottom of the ocean. We wouldn't predict everything lived at the bottom of the ocean. He says, enter the fossil record. Now, there were more then. We've gotten less now and no new ones, but they were all that we have now were there when the explosion took place. Now, according to the evolutionists themselves, the antagonistic witnesses then, we have those beginnings complex and suddenly right at the start, they're advanced as if they were just planted there. Again, this is not the creationist, this is the evolutionist. We won't have time in this presentation to document all of this. It will be documented in the handout that's available at the back. Sometimes we're told in the textbooks there's nothing but shallow seas anywhere in the Cambrian. Well, we've got 60 genera of land plants, including 6 vascular plants or woody plants, trees. We also have all the major anatomical designs, the chordata, all its major divisions. We have vertebrates from dozens of states. And we have, since the Cambrian, no new phyla. Now, I couldn't have written that better myself. When we think about what's predicted and what we find, that's pretty delightful as far as the creationists are concerned. The predictions are fulfilled. They are contradicted with evolution. Yet this is what we've got in the textbooks. That's not what we have in the fossil record. In fact, Gould says that. The evolutionary trees that adorn our textbooks have data. The rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of the fossils. In fact, he indicates in his book, Wonderful Life, that if you turn it upside down, it's closer because you've got more then than you've got now, and it's gone downhill. He says the sweep of anatomical diversity reached the maximum right after the initial diversification of multicellular animals. Now, he believes that there was this evolutionary diversification, but what he sees is the maximum diversity right at the start, as if they were just planted there. The later history of life proceeded by elimination, not expansion. And then he has a chapter actually ridiculing the idea of this cone of diversity, as he refers to it, which is predicted to the evolutionist, this simple beginning that gradually progresses upward and gets more diverse. He says, no, the diversity was greater at the beginning, and it has gone downhill. Now, it doesn't take somebody real bright to understand which of the two models is served best by that evidence, as acknowledged by the antagonistic witness. It's the opposite of what we see in the textbooks. Well, where did this come from? Well, the textbooks have this because of the assumption of evolution. This is the way it ought to be, and so that's the way it's drawn. As Gould says, it is. He says, Roger Lewin, the editor of Research and Views in Science, writing in his book Bones of Contention, tells us how this tree of life is put together. There is a fundamental basic assumption. The key issue is the ability to correctly infer genetic relationship between two species on the basis of a similarity in appearance. And then they line up the similarities according to this tree, beginning, of course, with the simplest at the bottom. But the basis of this is similarity. That's how they put it, not because of the fossils. He acknowledges this is deceptive, though he believes in the system, partly because similarity of structure does not necessarily imply identical genetic heritage. A shark, which is a fish, a porpoise, which is a mammal, look similar. When we see these two fish, they look similar. And if you agreed with that statement, I caught you, because while they look like fish, neither of them are. One's a reptile, one's a mammal, neither are fish. But they look similar, but they're not kin. And so this is not a consistent principle. And when we look at critters like the platypus, by this principle, he's kin to almost everybody. He's got a bill like a duck and webbed feet. He's like a beaver. The old adage is, that which proves too much proves nothing. When you look at the whole picture of similarities, and we need to look at similarities when we're talking about fossils, because that's how you line them up. Without the association based on similarities, you have no, the fossils don't say anything. They're just a bunch of dead things and rocks. And so based on the similarities, they're able to line them up. And yet this basis is very inconsistently applied. Some similarities, just some, many are ignored. We look at blood serum, the chimpanzee is very similar. In fact, with the right antiserum, you can actually interchange at times. But when you look at milk chemistry, not so. The donkey is much closer than the chimpanzee. When you look at cholesterol, well, lo and behold, the garter snake has cholesterol like we do. In terms of foot structure, which we've been interested in our work down at Glen Rose, what's similar to the human foot? Some footprints look like human feet. Well, the glacial bear is closest, not the ape. He's got a hand for a foot, doesn't he? Now, with the glacial bear, his hands are reversed. The thumbs are on the outside, and got claws and the quadruped. You don't confuse the two, but you take the claws off and the skin off and the flesh, and wow, that looks... Chicken has tear enzyme like... Well, it is lysosome. We have that in our eyes to help fight bacteria. The chicken needs it in the egg to fight bacteria. Very, very complex protein. Blood antigen A, lo and behold, you find that in the butter bean. In terms of brain hormone, amazingly, the cockroach has the same brain hormone we have. Notice this from Discover Magazine. Don't squash that roach. He may be your cousin. Cockroach and man, it seems, share a common brain hormone. We see similarities, but this is not a branching pattern that we're looking at here. We're looking at that mosaic pattern of similarities. When you look at the whole picture, it often looks very different. The evidence, the fossil record, the only direct evidence, has a critical beginning that is complex, abrupt, diverse, all the phyla there, more than we got now, none new since. These trees of life are from selected similarities. They are not from the fossils. The similarities reveal a mosaic pattern, not a branching pattern. When we proceed then in the fossil record, Notice the description, again, by the antagonistic witness, Stephen Gould, who devoutly believes in evolution. We can tell, but in honest moments, we must admit that the history of complex life is more a story of multifarious variation about a set of basic designs than a saga of accumulating excellence. Now, I told you, you'd think some of these were creationists, but they're not. He talks of designs which he doesn't believe in, but that's what it looks like, and you catch him using the term from time to time, and maybe honest moments, as he put it. This is the picture that we see rather than the progression. Darwin understood this problem. Many people think Darwin was convinced of the fossil record. From Origin of the Species, we read innumerable transitional forms must have existed, but why do we not find them embedded in countless numbers in the crust of the earth? And why is not every geological formation, every stratum full of such intermediate links? He says that's not the case. Geology assuredly does not reveal any such graduated organic chain, and this perhaps is the greatest objection which can be urged against my theory. A lot of people think that Darwin was bolstered by and encouraged by the fossil record. He studied it a great deal. No, this, he said, was the greatest problem. This is delightful to the creationist, but it's a problem for the evolutionist. Many would say, well, that was back then. It's gotten better. No, it's gotten worse. The senior curator of invertebrate paleontology, this is the largest fossil museum in the United States, says Darwin was completely aware of this. He was embarrassed by the fossil record. We're delighted. They're embarrassed. One fits the predictions, one doesn't. This is their description, because it didn't look the way he predicted it would. Well, he says, we're now about 120 years after Darwin. The knowledge of the fossil record has been greatly expanded. We now have 250,000 fossil species, but the situation hasn't changed much. Ironically, we have even fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we had in Darwin's time. It goes on to mention several that are often touted in the textbooks, like the horse series and Archaeopteryx and some of those. It's gotten worse, and we've lost some of the ones that we thought we had. Derek Ager, when this was written, was president of the British Geological Association, says it must be significant that nearly all of the evolutionary stories I learned as a student have now been debunked. The textbooks don't always tell us that. D.B. Kitts says evolution requires intermediate forms. This is the way you would see evolution. Paleontology does not provide them. The fact that discontinuities are almost always insistent, this is systematic, he says. This is genuine historical knowledge. S.M. Stanley of Johns Hopkins says the fact the fossil record does not convincingly document a single transition. Now, you'll find people with pages of these transitions, and put them on a page and saying the transitions doesn't make them so. Those who would love to say otherwise, the antagonistic witness says there's not one. Stewart says, our faith postulates its existence, but the faith, the type, fails to materialize. Corner says to the unprejudiced, the fossil record is in favor of special creation. Why? Well, it's complex, abrupt, diverse, all the file at the beginning. We have that which delights the creationist and embarrasses the evolutionist. It was Darwin's biggest problem, worse now. The links, one by one, have been debunked. They certainly devoutly believe in evolution, but they acknowledge, even in their own words, that the fossils favor creation. There's good reason for that. That's not Sunday school material. That's the fossils. That's the evidence, the facts. And that's why, I think, because of the evidence, primarily from those who are devout evolutionists who would love to say otherwise, give you their right arm not to have to say some of the things they say. But I think it's an open and shut case. The predictions are met. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And we can just take a second to get the projectors. The projector in?
It's coming up.
Okay. We had a little problem earlier.
Wait for the picture to come up.
What's that?
Wait for the picture to come up. It's coming. A little more time. A little more time. No, no, it's getting brighter. Come on. The sun is coming up.
Okay. Can you? I suppose everybody can hear me.
Can I get your
response? Oh, please.
Okay. And now we have John Blanton with the fossil record is not more compatible with the
modern
creation than
the fossil. I'm John Blanton. I'm with the North Texas Skeptics, which is a local nonprofit organization. I've known Don Patton for over 10 years. I go to his meetings. I've been going since about 1989. I kind of feel like Einstein's fictitious chauffeur. He chauffeured Dr. Einstein around to all these lectures. And he sat in the back of the room listening to the lecture so long that pretty soon he was able to give them himself. And I won't go ahead and tell the rest of the joke now, but I'll get into this talk. Back here at the table we have Danny Barnett. Danny Barnett will give away everything from the North Texas Skeptics is absolutely free. Danny will give you copies of the newsletter. He'll tell you how to join the North Texas Skeptics. I have brought copies of the presentation plus some other material of CD-ROMs. I only brought about 10 CD-ROMs. You're going to have to share it, guys. Afterwards, in fact, right now, if you were to log on right now, you can get a copy of this presentation off our website. So jot this down. If you don't get a copy of the presentation of CD-ROM, you can just... what I'm going to say is that the fossil record is not more compatible with the model creation than the model evolution. Well, what are we talking about? When we got started in this, nobody ever said, well, what is the model for creation? What is the model for evolution? We just assumed that everybody knew what this meant. We never did define the term. It's kind of a backward way to get into a debate. But here we go. I get to define it. And I'm going to say that the creation model is a myth. It's based on the Bible. The creation model that Don talks about, that he preaches at his meetings every month, are all biblical based. First, and the second thing I'll say is there's no such thing as a model of evolution. The so-called model of evolution, once again, is just a bit of fiction. And I'm going to give you some illustrative examples. We'll go a page up. Okay, the mythical creation model is based on the Bible. And here's what it is. The earth and the whole universe were created by a supernatural person all about the same time. Problem is, there are two contradictory versions of it. If you go to Genesis 1.1 to 1.31, there's one version. You go to Genesis 2, there's another version. They don't reconcile. They tell a different story. It comes with the known geological formations. Here's the Genesis myth number one. Day one, sky, earth, light, as they're all. All of you, I'm sure everybody here has read Genesis, or you probably wouldn't be in this room, so I'm not going to go ahead and read the whole thing to you. Myth number two is that, as you see, it's different. Earth and the heavens start out as misty, then Adam, the first man on the desolate earth, then the plants, and then the animals, and then Eve, the first woman created from Adam's rib. Now, the Bible accounts for the fossil record. Really? First of all, there's no mention of continents or anything beyond about a 400-mile radius of what is now Jerusalem. There is no mention of plate tectonics in the Bible. There's no mention of fossils at all. Trilobites are completely absent in the biblical record. The Bible doesn't mention trilobites once. To geologists and paleontologists, trilobites are a big thing. How did the Bible miss this? Whatever happened to the dinosaurs? They're not in the Bible either. And to say nothing of us believing the fossil record. What is the mythical model of evolution? Well, I'm going to disappoint you. It's only science. It's just hundreds and thousands of real scientists, people who've gone to college, worked real hard, got degrees, spend their lifetimes in careers working, doing real science, and developing this science. They developed the science of cosmology, developed the science of geology, paleontology,
biology, and never once going back and referring to some magical person to explain everything.
Surprise! Guess what? Evolution and modern geology were developed by creationists. James Hutton and Charles Lyell were creationists. They developed the modern science of geology. Charles Darwin was a creationist up until he made his trip and began to study the various fossils and other examples, other specimens that he collected on his trip, and developed the modern science of evolution, or the evolutionary theory, which really, I guess, as far as Charles Darwin is concerned, is developed the idea of natural selection, because evolution is an idea that has been around for thousands of years.
What is true?
Well, it's not the Bible. First of all, Adam and Eve are fictitious. Noah is a fictitious character with no purpose because there was no blood. Abraham, a mythical figure as well. Moses, who is Moses? Charlton Heston, as everybody knows. Science is true. And I'm going to tell you what is true. First of all, the sun was formed by the collapse of hydrogen and helium gas in deep space. The Earth was formed by the accretion of heavy elements. The heavy elements were formed deep within a large star that went critical, formed within a supernova. The Earth is about 4.5 billion years old. That is to say, it existed as an accreted object about that time. Life started spontaneously on Earth about 3.8 billion years ago, and we are all descended from that first life. More of what is true. The fossil record reflects this great lineage. We're all descended from common life 3.8 billion years ago, and the fossil record shows this. The fossils of ancient forms are in ancient formations. The fossils of more modern forms do not appear until more. Biochemistry furthermore reinforces this lineage, and without contradiction. There is no contradiction anywhere of the fossil record by modern biochemistry. And this is through, for example, analysis of DNA and protein sequences.
Why is the creation model false? Because creationism wants a young Earth. But the Earth is old. Origins of layered sediment, including barbs, which I'll explain, Green River Formation. Here's a list of things that I'll get to if I have time. This material is taken from this website here, so when you get a copy of the presentation, you can log on and get this material yourself.
Here are barbs. You don't think the Earth is old? Geologists will tell you about barbs. Barbs show how yearly dates, like tree rings do, seasonal changes within a lake, within an ancient lake, stream flowing into the lake, deposited layers of sediment, a different color for a different season. Year after year, dark light, each couplet representing one year. Some formations with all of these are invariably one year per couplet. But the ones that do stack up much more easily, much more time than the Bible will allow for.
The geological record shows multiple glaciations. Once again, these are quotes from a website, and here's the reference. You have to go back and refer to this for the rest of the text.
Shows the multiple glaciations, and I'll get to that.
Late Ordovician tilli are sandwiched between overlying 500 meter thick marine shale and underlying sandstones and clay beds, and the 300 to 400 meters thick layer what's above it. The tillites range from a few meters to 200 meters thick.
These tillites are soils that are produced by the glaciation process. The tillites take a long time to form. They're formed by the glaciers, and there are multiple layers of them. You're going to have to ask yourself, if the creation model is true, if all of these geological strata were formed in one great big flood or a series of floods, or even just a few hundred years or a few thousand years,
they're not going to be able to account for this. Here is a diagram that I've drawn. Shows on the bottom a marine sediment. On top of the marine sediment is a glacial tillite, which is formed by a glacier. On top of that is another marine sediment. The idea of this forming during a few years, a few thousand years, especially during the time of a 100-day flood, is fairly absurd.
Now, I haven't shown you everything. There are cases where we have multiple stacks of this, where this goes on more than this. It shows multiple glaciation periods interspersed with periods of marine sediment.
Angular unconformities.
This is
evidence of an older angular unconformity. The exposure shown above, the picture you just saw, is similar to what James Hutton saw. The sedimentary rocks below were formed horizontally, and then later a tectonic event lifted them, and it tilted. And now we had all of these layers that had been horizontal at an angle, and then erosion, and up till the upper surface was nearly level. And a new surface formed on top of that. This is not something that you would find happening in a 100-day flood. And to make a long story short, you can read all of this. This is one of the things that gave James Hutton the idea, convinced him that the Earth was really old. His interpretation of the angular unconformity was thus a watershed in the history of geology,
absolutely refuting the idea of a worldwide flood causing all of these geological formations.
This is another argument.
If it was God's purpose to make everything, why did he go through all of this process, build up all these layers, and then wear them down, put them at an angle, saw them off, put more layers on top of them? It's a nice argument. I like that argument.
Weathering and erosion. Some soils take a long time to form. We have layers of certain kinds of paleo soil that take millions of years to form. It's completely incompatible with being formed during a worldwide flood.
Salt deposits. We have salt deposits that are thousands of feet thick and is allowed to dry up over periods of thousands and millions of years.
And then we have carbonates on top of that, and then in some cases I think we have salt layers on top of the carbonates.
This is another thing that's completely incompatible with a 100-day-old flood that's causing all these marine geological formations. I'm going to skip over this. I'll use this material later on when you get back to it.
DNA of humans and other animals. I
kind of touched on protein differences between different species. I'll get back to that during the rebuttal period.
The bottom line is, based on the sequence of amino acids in carbonic in high grade 1I, you can more or less form this tree. And this, based on the, in fact, scientists do this. Based on the differences of the amino acids, common amino acids, but in different forms for the different organisms, they can get a very good idea of how far back they branched off. Don talked about the lack of branching, and yet when you look at the biological evidence, you see the branching. And it's not only here in the amino acid sequences, it's also in the DNA. Evolution makes sense of homologies. Richard Owen, who was, as I recall, a creationist, introduced the term homology to refer to the structural similarities among organisms.
The homologies bear out the branching structure of all the organisms, the branching relationship of the living organisms.
Evolution makes sense of the homologies. Why would certain cave-dwelling fish have degenerate eyes that cannot see?
It's because their ancestors once lived outside in the light and needed the eyes. Once more, I'll refer to the genetic code to later.
the genetic code or protein coding gene is nearly universal in the two kinds of cells. The the eukaryotes and the prokaryotes. So we are made of eukaryotic cells, that is to say, our cells have well-defined nuclei with the nucleus wall. Bacteria are prokaryotes. Among living organisms, it is similar despite the fact that there exist many equally good genetic codes. In other words, you could have built this a different way. You could take a chemistry student. If you were good enough in chemistry, you'd been good enough at work, you could build a human being from scratch. You don't have to use exactly the same sequence of DNA to construct a human being. As long as it produces the correct proteins in the cell at the right time, you can generate a human being. And he will obviously have no lineage in common with all these other animals in the world. And yet, we do. When you examine our biochemistry, you see that we are related very distantly to all of these other life forms through a common ancestor. Oh, common life evolution. For people who say there's no observed common evolution, here's something. Although the fossil record is often poor and incomplete, there are certain ways. These aren't my words. Look at the thing at the bottom. This is the source of this material, so I'm not taking credit for this. The fossil record is long according and incomplete. There are certain deposits where sedimentary layers remain in nearly continuous series. Fossils from these series, Sheldon examined a series of sedimentary layers from the Ordovician period about 500 million years ago containing trilobite fossils, which are now extinct. And the samples were obtained from every 3 million years, and the number of ribs in each species of trilobite changed over time. Some of these changes over time were so large that the animals at the end of the series are assigned a new genus. For those who say that there are no intermediate, fossils, this is the kind of example. The trilobites are so well preserved. I'm not just going to get into for one thing, are little one-celled animals, and they produce a hard shell, and we go about them through their shells. I'm going to move forward and show you the picture. Here is an illustration from the website. I advise people to go back, examine this material yourself. The creationists usually do not invite people at their meetings to go back and examine the source material. For over 10 years, I very seldom see these guys go back and examine the source material, and for good reason. Well, evolution. Oh, the evidence. Here's the known sequence of whale evolution from land animals to modern whales. The synonyms. The Pachycetus, the Amulocetus, the Rosocetus, the Dosaurus, and the Urodon. If I have enough time, I'll get into some of this. Here's a skull reconstruction. This is a land animal, which is thought to be an ancestor of modern whales. And here's the Pachycetus skull reconstruction, which is a layer. Descendants along the lineage. Here is the Amulocetus man hand. I'm not familiar with that particular form. This is a reconstruction of a full skeleton. Notice the hind legs. The whales have hind legs. Yet here is an ancestor of a whale with hind legs. The Rosocetus, he's more adapted for swimming than he is for walking on land. There's kind of thought that this animal is not very good on land at all. It probably is not. And here's another reconstruction. This is most likely this is all the pajama, one particular fossil.
And then here's the National Park Service. As I understand it, it's the official fossil of the state of Mississippi and the state of Alabama. There are a lot of them found in this country, in the southeastern United States. This was a completely marine animal and was very close to modern era. I'm going to allow that scientists think that this guy has no modern descendants. The Basilosaurus, many real scientists think Basilosaurus died out and did not leave any descendants, but he was along the lineage that resulted in the modern race. And there's the Uridon. And you notice, down there below the skeleton, towards the back, what are those? Those are the things now no longer need to be. Natural selection is deselecting these feet. The feet are going away. And this is what we see in modern whales today. We see an animal that supposedly was created at one time to live in the ocean, and then for some reason he was given useless feet. These useless feet are the remnants of his ancestors. This is what he got from his land-dwelling ancestors. In fact, it's big to have time later on, I'll get into the animal that we're pretty sure was the real ancestor of modern whales, which was an angular, a gravy, two-toed, or in fact two-toed animal. The closest thing to the modern whale that we find on land today is most likely the hippopotamus or something like something in the same family. So I'm going to write this down now, and then I'll turn the talk. Oh wait, I get to do the rebuttal now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have 15 seconds.
No, I get to.
Thank you. I was beginning to get a little bit disappointed. I thought we weren't going to be getting to the fossil record. He finally did get to that. I thought we had agreed to debate the fossil record, though most of it had nothing to do with the fossil record. Reminded me of the write-up in the Nashville, Tennessean several years ago when Dr. Gish debated one of the professors there at the University of Texas, and the reporter, who was an evolutionist, wrote up the debate and said, Dr. Gish is the one that talked about the fossil evidence, whereas the opponent thumped the Bible, and that's what he talked about, and that was the reverse of what he had expected, which is pretty much what we witnessed here this afternoon. A myth based on the Bible. Well, I'm not going to debate the Bible this afternoon. I agreed and signed a paper saying I was going to debate the fossil record, and so that's what I'm going to be talking about. If you'd like to debate the Bible, I'm going to keep my word and debate what I said we were going to debate. It's tempting to answer some of that which is very easily answered, but I'm going to keep my agreement. A major portion of it, maybe a third of the presentation, was on the age of the earth. Well, that may indirectly relate to the issue of the fossil record, but that's not the fossil record. He talks about bars and just gives the a priori statement that proves the old age. It takes a year, maybe a little bit more sometimes. In the secular literature, that has been severely discounted. The Green River Shale shows catfish with adipose tissue 4 and 5 inches thick that are covered with dozens of these barbs. Now, it's going to lay there for years and years and years. Adipose tissue still preserved. Now, that had to be preserved rapidly, covered quickly. At Mount St. Helens, there was over 600 feet of quarter-inch laminate laid down one afternoon at about 150 miles an hour. 600 feet of quarter-inch laminate. It's rock. You hit it with a hammer. It's hard as a, it rings like a bell. It does not take a long time to do that. Tillite takes as long as it takes for the glacier to melt. There is no factor in tillite itself that requires age. That's just an affirmation unsupported. And likewise with angular unconformities, if you have the turbulence of a flood, which was a subject you brought up, wasn't my doing, then you do exactly that kind of thing. It is a direct prediction of that. It doesn't take millions of years to form soil. That's just, what was the evidence that he gave for that? Anybody hear him? Just asserted it. A number of volcanic islands have been completely viable within 50, at least 100 years. You look at Mount St. Helens, the area that was sterile as the moonscape, as it was described, is now blossoming and blooming and doing just great. And it hasn't taken millions of years, thousands of years, hundreds of years. The soil is doing fine, though it was completely wiped away. He talked about the phylogeny of primates and says, this shows evolution. There's an awful lot of evolutionary assumption involved in arranging the phylogenies, and it depends on which authorities you quote to say how they line up and line them that way. Colin Patterson is not a lightweight. He's curator of the largest fossil museum in the world, British Museum of Natural History. He spoke on that at the American Museum of Natural History, quoted in Science. He said, the prediction is made that these phylogenies would appear out of the biochemical evidence, and the prediction is precisely falsified. You have predictions of kinship that are bizarre, that do not fit. I just deny that that is the case. You can see some that would line up, and actually when you look at the interior structure, you see similarity. That gets back to the point we were making a moment ago. When you look at the entire picture, you see a very different thing. I want to move to similarities here for just a second. And he mentioned the chromosomes. This is not an argument he made. Well, actually, he hinted at it. Let's turn this on, Ross. This is in a number of textbooks where the argument, now, again, we're not on the fossil record, but I'm following somebody who's off track. You look at the chromosome, the number of chromosomes, and it looks like evolution. You look at the whole picture, though, when you get more information, as we've gotten now, we see it's about 80. The turkey has 82. We've just got 46. In terms of amount of DNA, humans have something like 3 billion base pairs. But you look at this particular plant, I won't try to pronounce it, he has 125 billion. Lungfish, 139 billion. Another plant at 160. Here's a couple of amoeba that are way off the chart in terms of amount of DNA. Well, I'm not sure that really says a whole lot about evolution, but we see arguments like that being made from time to time. Ross, just got that. He did get to the fossil record at the end. Trilobites. Prove evolution. Trilobites are found at certain levels, and that's exactly right. Many would affirm it is due to ecological zonation. Certain ones lived at this level, certain ones lived at that level. They would be buried where they lived. They are trilobites when they start. Some of the most beautiful, ornate, fanciest trilobites are right at the bottom of that Cambrian. Those are the complex organisms they were talking about. When they get through the evolutionary sequence that's assumed, it's still a beautiful trilobite. They have ribs that change, not necessarily because they evolve one another. There's a variety of them, varieties of horses. You see the ribs coming and going and coming and going. There's not this pattern that branches toward greater complexity at all. In fact, the greatest complexity is at the bottom. With foraminifera, we find exactly the same thing. In fact, we have found the exact sequence that you see in the textbooks in the ocean today, zoned by temperature zonation. Certain ones live at this temperature, certain ones live at that temperature. That's how they got buried, and so it's reflected in the fossil record just that way. In terms of whale evolution, many of these pictures he was showing here are beautiful pictures. The problem is you've got two or three bones in some instances that have been interpreted in this manner. He did not tell you what the original source material was at all. Many paleontologists will just get up and fight virulently against the idea that these are whales anyway. You got a few ankle bones, a few tail bones here and there. If they have feet and they're running around, it's difficult to call it a whale, some would say. Maybe not just for that reason. It is controversial even among evolutionary paleontologists. The vestigial feet are used to anchor muscles. They are very necessary, according to the anatomist. The assumption that they're vestigial, the real bad science that comes as a result of evolution. I might give an example of that if I can find. I'm looking here, not seeing it right now. We did have one who wrote up some material that I presented at the skeptics meeting. This was Ms. Vaughn, and he mentioned the vestigial organs, but the appendix came up at the meeting, and Patton claims, she says, that the doctors have now learned removing the appendix. Let's turn this on. Regularly is the wrong thing to do because we need them to produce antibodies. She says, first off, the appendix does not now, never has, in our evolutionary past, produced antibodies. It just hangs around. It's the catecholamine of organs, becomes inflamed. That's all it's good for. I've done medical search for 11 years, I'm at Southwestern and all of this. Here's a recent article. For years, appendix is credited with very little physiological function. We know it serves an important purpose. The fetus of the young, the adults, in the past is routinely removed during surgeries. Now the appendix is spared, and then a later article, among human adults, the appendix is now thought to be involved in production of antibodies, which is exactly what I said. Now, I don't have 11 years of medical research, but I evidently knew more than her, then blinded by her evolutionary philosophy, which has mutilated, butchered generations because they assumed this thing was useless based on the evolutionary philosophy. That's one of the consequences. This is the way you test a model. What are the predictions? Do they come true? We predicted it would be found to be useful. They predicted it would not, and they were wrong. The tillites, the varves, the trilobites, the few things that he did mention in the fossil record by no means prove his point, and most of it wasn't relevant to the fossil record at all. Thank you.
Don mentioned Stephen Jay Gould and the Cambrian explosion. He did not tell you the full story. Once again, like I said, I've been to the NEOS meetings for the last 10 or 12 years, and I see this time and time again. Tell a quick quote out of a famous book by a real scientist, someone who actually does work in the field, someone who actually has a degree in the field. And then take a quick quote out of his book, take it out of context, and put it up there. The guy seems to be saying the opposite of what he says if you go read the rest of the book. In fact, we did that one time. Jeff Umberger and I went to the VM's meeting a number of years ago. I think it was back in 1992. Don gave us a handout from his talk. There were a number of quotes from these handouts. Jeff Unbarger took the quotes over to the University of Texas at Dallas Library and looked up the source material. In many cases, pertinent passages had been deliberately deleted. Passages which explained that the author was saying exactly the opposite. In one case, the most egregious example I've ever seen, three phrases were taken from a couple of paragraphs. They were put together in a slightly different order, not in the same sequence that the original author had placed them. And then this was put up
on the screen for the audience to see. And it had the author, a real scientist, seemed to be saying the opposite of what he actually said in the full article. Now, since I cannot anticipate what the speaker will bring up at the debate, I couldn't bring all of this material, but it's all online. You have the North Texas Skeptics website. Log on. Look up our newsletters. All our newsletters back in 1987 are online. You can pull them up. You can see the original article with the original text from Don Patton's handout, the original text from the actual source, and you can make the comparison yourself. So, if Stephen Jay Gould seems to be saying that Stephen Jay Gould, one of the biggest supporters of evolution these days, seems to have a copy of his book, Wonderful Life, which was quoted here, I did not immediately bring up the original passage, which yet someone who uses this kind of approach a definite advantage. It's up to you people, as thinking individuals, to go and chase down the original material yourself, get a copy of Donald's handouts, go back to the original sources, go to our website. You will see it on our website following this debate. One of the things is, probably I wish Don had done that. I didn't need that much help. He brought up Green Gish's foolish business about the garter snake and the donkey milk and the butter bean. If you care to, if I don't have that on our website, I will shortly. This is very famous. We've been trying to get Green Gish to retract this bit of nonsense for about the last 20 years. And he keeps, I don't know, Green Gish has abandoned it entirely. It's still in his published works. Don Patton needs to dump it because it's not well supported. It's been well refuted. And I encourage you to look at information. We go get information from real scientists, people who actually do the work. We put it on our website. We put links to it so you can go and read the original source. And I have up here just a little bit. I noticed I didn't mention the appendix. This is what the argument to me is called a straw man. I'm not going to stand up and say we don't need the appendix. Maybe we do. I'm not an MD. But I didn't bring it up and I didn't use it. You bring up something like the appendix when you don't have a pretty good argument. You bring up something that you can easily defeat. A straw man is really not a very good fighter. You put up a straw man and say, look, this is the enemy, and then you destroy it. Which, in the case of the appendix, is maybe easier to do than the vestigial feet of the whale. If the vestigial feet of the whale were put there just to anchor some muscles, then why do they look like feet? Why do they have toes? Why isn't there something that functions better at anchoring the muscles than some feet that were left over from the whale's land ancestors? He says he has some real geologists and paleontologists looking at some things and saying these are
whales are descended from things that are not whales. So what's the problem there? The preserved fish in the Green River. Once again, there's a link to that on our website. If you follow some of the material in the handout that I gave you, you have real scientists, people who actually do work in this field, talking about the anaerobic conditions that existed on occasion, not always, that allow a specimen to be preserved long enough to be covered by several layers of yearly barbs. The chromosome count foolishness. This is easy to look. I don't even know why Don brought this up. Any good biochemist can put this down. Obviously, there are some more primitive life forms like certain kinds of worms. There's a worm that I know, I can't remember his name. It's got more chromosomes than a human being, of course. What does that say? My advice, rather than listen to a creationist lecture, go back and learn some of the material. Back in 1989, I started attending the VLS lectures. I started hearing these weird arguments, and I thought to myself, you know, I need to learn more about this stuff. I was telling Jim earlier before the meeting, I need to go get a degree in geology. But then I thought, gee, I won't pay for that. But they will pay for a degree in physics. So I went back to school, and I got a master's degree in physics. But the question I asked to the creationists, what are you willing to do? You have these questions. Why don't you go back to school, learn some of these things that you're talking about, so you no longer talk of ignorance, get a real degree, and then put yourself, do research alongside real scientists doing real science. I know a creationist is a real scientist. He came to the meeting one time, and he said, look, guys, I'm a geologist. He said, I believe in God. I believe God created all this. But this young earth business is a bunch of crap. You send your kids to college, they're going to learn that all this stuff that you've been teaching them in church is a bunch of crap. One of the persons in the NEOS meeting says, well, then don't send them. And I guess that's the creationist approach to the whole thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Once we have the projectors going again,
John mentions he's been going to the meetings for some time, which is of course true, and then writing it up, and it is online, but what he has online is disgusting. Let me show you. He just doesn't get it regarding the quotes. Here he says, and this is quoting from the newsletter online, where we have been able to cross-check the citations against the actual text, we have noted the classic out-of-context stunt is being pulled to make it appear that mainstream science supports the NEOS view. Well, I think I may have gotten him off of that in the presentation just a moment ago. These are evolutionists. They don't support the NEOS view. Absolutely not so. That's my point. I want you to know they're antagonistic witnesses. That makes their evidence, their testimony stronger. No, we are not saying that, but this is what he says we said that isn't true. He gives a specific example. Radiometric dating methods, says Don Patton, for example, are just about worthless, even according to the anti-creationist scientists such as William D. Stanfield. According to him, Stanfield said, these things are worthless. And you can get that impression from what he wrote because he gives all of the reasons why they're not that dependable, but he devoutly believes in them. He doesn't think they're worthless. In Patton's handout that he mentions, and that he mentions on the website, Patton says this under the heading, this is my heading, Stanfield's answer, all the above methods for dating the age of the Earth, and he's referring to young age methods, and he acknowledges there are a lot of reasons for a young Earth. They're all questionable, though, he says. And then here's what I said about his conclusion, a method that appears to have much greater reliability for determining absolute ages of rocks is that of radiometric dating. Now, John says, I said he said they were worthless. What I actually said was he believed in it devoutly. He just doesn't get it, and he misrepresents, obviously, as the lady who talked about the appendix did. And, of course, he brought up the vestigial organs with the whales. Why aren't they this way? Why aren't they that way? At this point, he's playing theologian. That's not the subject. Theologically, I don't think John's had training in theology. He might have gotten a lot of training in physics, but he's lacking, sadly, in theology. And I'd be glad to try to sit down and discuss that subject, but that's not the subject today. He talked about Gish needing to, needing to retract the nonsense about the snake cholesterol. He gave no evidence. In fact, didn't even hear him say the snake didn't have cholesterol. Is that what you're saying? That's all. If you're saying the snake doesn't have cholesterol, you're going to be very foolishly embarrassed. The snake certainly does. And so do the other facts. I stand by that chart just as it was presented. And just saying it's nonsense, of course, he presented the evidence, didn't he? No. That wasn't the case. He said, I misrepresented, and I had all of these things where it said exactly the opposite. Well, where's the example? It would have been, if he's got an example like that, don't you think he would have brought it and shown it to you? I can show you an example specific, as you just saw, where he claimed I misrepresented when I did not. They're on the back table. You multiply them by about four, that's there with them. Original sources, you go check for yourself. I have been, you can go. I want you to take that material and go look at it. Now, he said we don't go to the original sources and then said I gave out handouts with the original sources on it. Isn't that interesting? He knew better when he said it to start with. But a whole page of the original sources with all of the quotes, you go see if they're, would I just misrepresent the thing entirely and then say, here, you go look at it? Well, you'll find out. Obviously, these men are revolutionists. You can get upset when you look at this and say, ah, these men are revolutionists after all. Well, yes, that's the point. But they acknowledge points that are very detrimental to their position, and their acknowledging it makes it much more significant. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Don. All right. I'll recapitulate. I'm so happy that Don brought part of the article from our newsletter back in May of 1992. I guess if I had been a psychic, I would have brought the entire article. It would have been very interesting to read. However, you can still go read the article. I stand by what I said. I was at the meeting. Don gave the presentation. He deliberately left the audience with the opinion that the author was against evolution, against radiometric dating, when the author really was not an enemy of radiometric dating. The author was picking some fine aspects of it. He obviously has a heart problem with some cases where it's misapplied. Once again, you got a copy of the link to the website. Please go check it out. On the website, there's an email link to me. You can send me an email right back to me in case I'm wrong. This is almost April 2002. The thing has been out there for 10 years, and we've never gotten anyone who has had any heart problem with this. Maybe go get some in the future. Maybe we'll begin to get some. The deal about Dwayne Gish and the butter beans and the garter snake and the cholesterol, I'll stand by that. And if I don't have a link to that on the website, we'll certainly put it. When I said that the creationists don't go back and check the original, I don't mean that Don doesn't read the original. Don reads the original. As far as I can tell, Don reads Science magazine of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, of which I'm a member, and I have a subscription. You read science news because I see many quotes in there. So I read a lot of good science. The question is, why doesn't he put it all in this presentation? These articles are written by real scientists who've gone to school, studied hard, worked all the way through, taken all the quizzes, gone to work in the field, made it their last work, and worked earnestly for years and compiled this information and written these items, written these articles. This is where the real science is. The real science is not found in these books that you see sold at the creationist meetings. They're not found, real science is not found on these creationist websites. Creationists don't have any science. You'll notice we've been here any science that was in support of the creationist viewpoint. He's been attacking real science by quoting real scientists out of context, very little context for the entire quote. He says that we do not give our sources. I'm sorry that I can't go through and read my entire presentation from beginning to end. You have a copy of it. I've given copies of CDs if any back here. You can get a copy of the CD for free. We don't sell anything. We're a public service organization. It's all right. That's on the website right now. You can go get a copy of it. You can see all the sources, all the source material. Don has some heartburn with the paleo soil. Some very big scientists, real scientists doing real work, have determined how long it takes to form bauxite, for example, by the weathering of exposed rocks. These are very slow processes. They cannot be accelerated. And yet we have instances of this soil. Inside, the soil is where it was originally formed, not washed down from somewhere else. And it is many feet thick.
Are we out of time? Okay.
And then we can get on to the question and answer period. Thank you very much for coming down.
Concludes the formal part of the debate. We're not going to move on to question and answer. The way we're going to structure this is we're going to first have a question for Dr. Patton. He'll have 2 minutes to give an answer, and then John Black will be able to comment on the answer, and then we're going to switch. So we'll be able to load the question to John Black, to which Dr. Patton will be able to respond. Okay, so first, question for Dr. Patton.
We have one over here who's got a great shirt. Hi, Mike Jordan. First of all, that's Pat.
One other point I forgot to make is that when you ask a question, no one organizing, if you have a comment about the presentation, give it to them afterwards. I want to hear one sentence or a question right here. Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I'm going to try to pitch a moment. Regarding the quote being used from Stephen Gould, don't you think it's completely disingenuous when you avoid the fact that he was setting a stage for his punctuated equilibrium theory of explaining the elements of the existing Darwinist theory, that what he was setting a stage for was a punctuated equilibrium, the same way that Ptolemy's original model of the universe was theorized as circular and modified by later discovered evidence by Galileo Galilei. So the question is, don't you think it's disingenuous for you to hold those exact views of Galilei?
Okay, I think that was loud enough that I don't think you're repeating.
Okay. There are various ways to explain different phenomena. One could be disingenuous. One could be I didn't have enough time. I understand the frustration and somewhat agree with what you're saying. Yes, he is admitting these things because he thinks he has another answer. And I wish I had time to talk about his other answer. That's on my, as you can see, on the laptop here. Let me go to what punctuated equilibrium is, the reasons you don't find all these fossils is because it went too fast and you can't really see it. Unobserved mechanisms, they don't know why it went that fast. They have unobserved fossils and they're telling you a story about why you don't observe them. On the other hand, we have observed mechanisms, observed fossils. I think it's obvious which is better science. I think Colin Patterson really hit the nail on the head. He said, well, it seems that they've accepted that the fossil record doesn't give them the support they would value, so they searched around to find another model and found one. When you haven't got the evidence, you make up a story that'll fit the lack of evidence. This is not an explanation. It's a reason why you don't have the fossils, and that's not really good science. We have better science than that. But, yes, that's true. He's saying these things because he thinks he has the other answer. I think the other answer is worse than the one he had to start with, as does Patterson, who's curated the British Museum of Natural History.
Okay, John, 2 minutes. Okay, regarding Stephen Jay Gould's comments, taken out of context. When you first heard, when Donald gave you that line, when he gave you that presentation, you had in your mind some idea that he was trying to convey. He's a very good speaker, and he put across this idea. Think for a moment. Don't answer me right now. Think for a moment. What was the idea that you were getting across? I guess, or I'm going to guess, that the idea that you saw being put to you was that Stephen Jay Gould didn't think much of evolution. Now, this is what the speaker wanted to convey. Why is he doing it this way? When we know that Stephen Jay Gould is one of the greatest champions of evolution in the public forum today. And the answer is, you seem to come some quotes, some remarks taken out of context. You don't see that whole thing. You go back and read Stephen Jay Gould's last work. Can you tell me if here is a guy who finds some problem with evolution?
Okay, and now a question for John Black. Anyone without a question? Okay, right there is the great short.
Yes, I think
your questions are about that for Dr. Patton.
Oh,
okay. If you have a question for Dr. Patton, you need to say it for the minister.
Okay.
Probably the third act would be with each chair.
Okay, yeah, I have a question. You talked about the number of chromosomes that you didn't really fully address it. Can you talk a little bit about complexity and its relationship to evolution?
I know absolutely nothing about biology, and nothing about paleontology, and nothing about geology. I'm going to answer that evolution does not always produce more complex organisms. Like I said, we noted some worms that have more chromosomes than people, more base pairs than the human DNA. The human DNA is by no means the most complicated, the most extensive DNA. However, once again, you need to go back to someone who really knows about this material, and that's still read the literature, read Science magazine, even read Nature, read the Scientific American, which is the last magazine for the lay reader, and learn about this stuff. This is not something that evolution requires. Is that things get more complex?
Yes. I just say first to anybody that got the impression that I was saying Google didn't want to get it. Regarding the question, are they more complex because they're older? We take the example of the trilobite, which was John's example. The trilobite is an astoundingly complex organism. This is found in abundance, in variety, great diversity, right at this lowest layer, the explosion of the Cambrian. It has eyes that are just spectacularly complex, more complex than our own. Corrected for chromatic aberration, we've only been able to do that in the last 50 years. If you buy a lens for your camera that's corrected that way, you've got to pay a whole lot more for it. This was not a simple creature. A differentiated head and tail and thorax with complex respiratory system and nervous system, that's the bottom. That's very complex. They lived on the bottom of the ocean. That's where we expect to find them, lowest, but not because they're simple. Any idea that they're simple, now the evolutionist predicts that there would be simple critters there, but that is not the case. Their prediction is falsified, and ours we find delightful.
Okay, we're going to do one more round, so questions for my back. You mentioned the research you got fired, you just had, you said, you showed that you had an observed mechanism. But I never see or anywhere where creationists try to explain how their creator allegedly created the hippopotamus from scratch. What is your observed mechanism of how this happened?
Okay. I had to run through that real quick, and I can understand how you would get that misimpression. I was talking about the mechanism for punctuated equilibrium. It started out, actually, back in the 30s, where Goldsmith came up with what he called the hopeful monster mechanism, where he says that mama reptile laid an egg and a bird hatched out. And most of the geneticists thought he was the one that laid the egg. But then Gould picked up on it and said he's going to call it punctuated equilibrium, that it just real quick went too fast, and he imagines maybe some change in the hot genes or something but it's never been observed. It's a totally unobserved mechanism to do this rapid change that's so fast you don't see it that explains why the gaps are there. And so he has the unobserved mechanism, and he has the unobserved fossils and explaining them, that is reproducing one kind after another kind. Every time you see reproduction, you see our mechanism for reproduction. It is after its kind, and we see millions of them. We've got all kind of examples observing that mechanism. I wasn't talking about the creative mechanism, and I don't have a clue for that. Because it is, the implication is this is not natural. This is supernatural because we can't get something for nothing and yet we got something, and so it is something we don't know about. That's a logical process. Not really the subject today. That's a theological, philosophical subject. We're talking about the fossil record, hopefully.
I'm sorry that Don really didn't get around to explaining the method of creation, and the reason is there isn't one.
Creationists don't
do science. They let the scientists go off and do science, and then they go pick at it out there. There's so much to pick at. Don equates punctuated equilibrium with the hopeful monster. I have to ask this question. If Don is so astute, and he studied this so much, and he studied geology and biology for all this, and how come he doesn't know the real explanation for punctuated equilibrium? How come he doesn't know what it is? He doesn't know about Gould's explanation, Gould and Miles Eldridge developed about 30 years ago. I mentioned before, but I don't have a degree in geology. I didn't take any geology courses in school. I didn't take any biology courses when I went to college. I went to boarding course. So you have to ask, well, who is he to come and go against the creationism, evolutionism? And I say, why should it be so easy that I can do it? If someone like me just comes in off the street, background is in engineering and physics and math, why am I able to debate this? Why do the creationists make it so easy for us?
Okay, my final question is about Latin, and that's it. Okay, in fact, it would be Asia. I thought you might call me my name, though. I'm sorry. If evolution is false and creation is true, shouldn't there be some kind of dramatic disconfirmation of evolution, for example, by finding a host cat skeleton in the same strata as a triceratops? Why would we not find antisperms, say, a gorilla in the same strata as a trilobite?
seems to me that there should be something that would dramatically discern for a revolution if in fact it was false.
This is a good question. I like that. This is something that the creationists have brought up. Look, evolution doesn't make any predictions. There's no experimentation, as Tim Bursky pointed out. Go to the fossil record. See if you find any contradiction. We've been looking at the fossil record seriously for over 200 years now. We haven't found any contradiction. Don will mention some cases where we have maybe a thing called a hodgepodge man, some human remains in some ancient sandstone. This has been very well refuted. He's going to probably mention some fossils, some veins in which younger fossils appear beneath older fossils. He's not going to explain how the geological formations got folded and turned over, or the evidence that the geologists have for determining when this happened, like the deformation of the rock, the heating of the rock that occurs when this happens, and the fact that you can see things that are obviously upside down, such as little scallops on the tops of soil when it's formed, it points up. And then, after the thing has been turned over, points down. The thing is, in all of the over 200 years of looking at this, we've never found any contradiction to the of evolution in the fossil record.